Hi, listeners. I'm your host, Rebecca Kelly, and welcome back to The Station, a fiction podcast about a girl named Ida Shepherd who's trying desperately to escape a dying space station called the Delta. Now, before we begin, I have a small favor to ask. If you're enjoying the story of The Station, please drop into your podcast player of choice and leave it a 5-star rating. This helps me reach more people, and I appreciate it so much. In the last few episodes, we've learned more about Ida's rescue mission, right? She's finally made contact with the surface after 18 years, and the folks at NASA, headed up by an engineer named Ali Bacchus, are trying to figure out a way to fix her broken ion engine before the Delta crashes into the atmosphere. In this episode, we'll see how the team at NASA is doing trying to fix that engine. And we'll take a look at the toll it's taking on Ale as he finds himself growing fonder and fonder of his new friend. Are you ready? Let's jump back into the story. Here is chapter 28 of The Station. This is totally unprecedented. Tess shook her head excitedly with a look of disbelief on her face. I mean, we couldn't have organized a better experiment if we tried. As she spoke, her hands moved around in great gestures, accentuating some of the more exciting points in her speech. I can't believe all the data these two women have kept on their health over the years, she said. I feel like I should pinch myself. Ale watched her from behind his holoscreen, interested to hear about her conversation with Ida. Tess was in her mid-40s, tall and athletic. She had a quirky sense of style and tended to wear things like bold prints and floral dresses. Today, she wore a turquoise and white geometric print dress that looked like it had been scooped out of a Picasso painting. As she continued to speak, hands flying around her head, she paced aggressively around the conference room table in the mission control room at Goddard. In the past, mission control was always located in Houston at Johnson Space Center, the mecca of human spaceflight. However, the complex suffered heavy damages during the war and was no longer in use. So the crew at Goddard transformed one of the largest conference rooms in the building into a temporary mission control. The room buzzed with movement as engineers worked at their holoscreens and talked on their phones while poring over data transferred from the Delta's computers. Located on the third floor at Goddard, the conference room was an unremarkable place to command such an important mission. The room was long and rectangular and painted a sturdy conference room beige. In the center of the room was a large oak conference table surrounded by sleek, black, ergonomic office chairs. This was the main meeting area where they held daily meetings to discuss the ever-changing plan. Around the perimeter of the room were 12 double desks, each holding the workspace of two engineers facing each other. The temporary mission control was hastily thrown together and crowded with holoscreens, telephones, network wires, and the inevitable litter that came from a group of scientists working long hours in a cramped space. NASA administration treated this project as a full-blown mission. Although it was crowded and smelled of commercial carpet, sweat, and body odor, the workspace didn't seem to bother the team. They understood the importance of their work. The elite engineering team consisted of 32 engineers, all taking on multiple roles and working around the clock. Ale was the primary CAPCOM and the flight director. Their primary objective was figuring out a way to get the Delta's engine back up and running to avoid a deadly atmospheric reentry. They all signed non-disclosure agreements stating that this mission would remain top secret. Armed guards stood on 24-hour watch over the entrance to the makeshift control room to ensure that only those who were necessary to the mission were allowed to enter. The guards also sent a clear message to those leaving the cramped room that anyone found spreading word of this new mission would suffer grave consequences. Personal holophones were tapped to ensure private communications made no mention of the mission, and every engineer was followed by an armed guard when they left the premises. Tess was the flight surgeon. Her medical research into human spaceflight over the last 6 years had been pivotal in advancing the manned space program, and the new information that Ida uploaded daily from the station logs was enough for 2 full years of research material. She couldn't believe her blind luck. So far, she had received almost half of Millicent Shepherd's pregnancy data and expected to have the full birthing details within the next few hours. "Ale, I'm telling you," she said as she continued to pace. "It's literally a miracle that this girl is still alive up there. And so far, she seems healthy. I asked her to do a full body ultrasound so we can check for precancerous cells, but she doesn't exhibit any of the normal signs of radiation illness. It's incredible." Ale was much less excited about the medical data. He had bigger issues on his mind. "Yes, Tess," he said. "I get it. It's exciting. But remember, if we can't get the engine working, there will be no more test subject to study. You seem to forget that we are still 18 months away from attempting even an unmanned mission using the Diamond spacecraft. Let's say we can get up there sooner. It's still at least a year out. That's too long." He shook his head in despair. Tess let out an excited squeal and said, "Oh, I realize that, Ale, but the data will still be here. I mean, years and years of records that she can send before the station deorbits." Her voice trailed off as she spoke the words. She stopped pacing and looked at Ale's eyes, which flashed with anger. She realized how callous she sounded. "Sorry, that was totally inappropriate," she said. Ale rose sharply from his seat and pointed his finger at her as he spoke. "That's unacceptable, Tess. We are going to bring Ida home. Get that through your head." He knew his tone was harsh, but he didn't care. The odds of saving Ida from the untimely deorbit were growing slimmer by the day. They would need every bit of positive energy they could to make this happen. "You're absolutely right," she said, nodding her head, her eyes dropping to the floor. I don't know what came over me. I apologize." Ale relaxed his gaze and sat down in his chair, pulling his holoscreen closer to him to get back to what he was working on. "Don't worry about it. Just give me a rundown of what you've got so far," he said. Tess continued her manic pace around the side of the table, saying, "Millicent had an affair with Andrei Fedorov, one of the other astronauts on board." "Wait," Ale said. "How do you know that?" "Because she kept detailed notes in her logs," Tess said. "They had been on board together for several months, and during that time, they conceived Ida. She wasn't sure when, so obviously it was an ongoing thing." Ale watched her from his seat on the other side of the table. Her excitement exhausted him. He had been awake most of the night, and his neck and back ached. He wasn't really in the mood to listen to her, considering she had just arrived only a few hours earlier and was working with a fresh brain. But he allowed her to continue, taking a break from the project open on his screen to take in what she had to say. Tess continued. "When she found out she was pregnant, she started doing regular ultrasounds and saving the results in her medical logs. She even created a separate file to document the baby's progress versus her own. She was a hell of a scientist." Tess finally came to a rest beside a tall black desk chair that sat empty at the table opposite Ale. Ale rubbed his temples. The historical medical data was great, but he was worried about the current state of Ida's health. He asked, "What can we expect when she does get down to the surface? Any ideas?" Tess shrugged. "Your guess is as good as mine. I'll know more in a few weeks. My initial thought is that since she grew up with partial gravity, her body will be similar to ours, just not quite as strong. She states that she exercises regularly, again, thanks to her mother, and although the gravity is limited, it's better than nothing at all. She'll be weak, of course, when she comes down to the surface, but I don't think it will be any worse than any regular long-term astronaut spaceflight." "Good," Ale nodded. "Well, that's my initial thought," Tess continued. "There could be any number of issues with her circulatory system, mental cognition, lymphatic health, you name it. But the fact that she's still alive really does say a lot about her health. Plus, she's eating a vegan diet, arguably one of the healthiest ways to eat. She gave me a rundown of some of her typical meals, and it appears that she's getting all the necessary nutrients, proteins, fats, amino acids, etc." An alarm went off on Tessa's holowatch, momentarily drawing her attention away from the conversation. I've got to go. I have a meeting with Patrick in 15 minutes, and I want to get a quick walk in before I meet him. Ali nodded, and Tess left the room. He turned back to his screen, having lost track of what he was working on, and decided that perhaps a walk would be beneficial for him as well. He hadn't left his chair in at least 3 hours, and his legs were suddenly stiff. Goddard Space Flight Center was situated on almost 1,300 acres of land just outside of Washington, D.C. The campus contained 34 buildings, along with parks, walkways, streets, parking lots, and various other storage and groundskeeping areas. Its facilities included the largest clean room in the world, used to assemble actual space vehicles, several large vacuum chambers that could be heated and cooled to unearthly temperatures, and a centrifuge capable of producing 30 times the force of gravity. The center was the oldest space center in the United States, responsible for tracking and computer support for early manned NASA missions, including the space stations of the past. But the primary aim of Goddard was to design and build unmanned scientific spacecraft, including the TDRS. Building 36 was located between the main gate and the south gate of the complex. A road encircled the center section of the campus where most of the buildings resided. Ali stepped out into the breezy night air. It was summer in Baltimore, and all around he could smell the scent of it. Thick groves of loblolly and Virginia pines, American sycamore, and pignut hickory dominated the grounds. The presence of the trees gave the campus an earthy, fresh scent. It reminded Ali of an orange grove he had once walked through during a visit to Florida as a child. It was a sweet smell, almost citrusy, and he was immediately invigorated by the breeze and the rustle of the leaves around him. He decided to walk down the road toward the campus library. There was a cafe there, open 24 hours a day, where he could get a strong cup of coffee. Sleep should have been his priority, but he knew that sleep would not come to him now. He had too many thoughts swirling through his mind. As he walked, he worked on sorting out the chaos in his head. He was immediately drawn to the Delta's engine. Ali had the most talented engineers in the world at his disposal. Over the last few days, they had scanned all of the mechanical systems on the Delta. For the most part, the computer and all the mechanics were working as they should. It was all that NASA could have hoped for when building a space station. Something that would stand the test of time and survive without help from the ground. It amazed him how well the 20-year-old technology had held up. But with the engine, they were not so lucky. The engineers figured that the electrical failure had taken place during the last use, a little less than 2 months prior. Ali chuckled to himself because Ida had told him that, going off of her own analysis of the situation. NASA, of course, wanted a second opinion from an expert on nuclear ion engines. The experts had come up with basically the same hypothesis Ida had. The engine had a major electronic meltdown during the last orbital maneuver and was subsequently fried. There was no backup. Could it be fixed? That, of course, was unknown. It probably could be fixed if they had access to a field expert who could do a spacewalk and look at it. And if that expert had the correct tools and parts to replace. But as far as anyone knew, those parts and tools, and the expert for that matter, did not exist on the Delta. The engineering team was stunned at how well she had kept the station running, considering the limited supplies she had on board. Ida had found ways to push everything she had to its limit, things like air filters, pumps, storage tanks, controller boxes. Antennas and battery units had surpassed their estimated lifespans. Preparing a spacewalk for Ida to repair the damage was considered an unnecessary risk. The Nix unit had taken detailed images of the fried electronics, and without a plan to repair them, having Ida go out into the void wouldn't do them much good. Ali continued walking and eventually turned from the main road onto a small walking path, the thoughts still churning in his head. He struggled with the idea that fixing the engine wasn't going to pan out. The only other option was to go get her, a much more dangerous option. Sending up the Diamond spacecraft, which had never been tested in space, could end up taking the lives of both the crew sent for the rescue and Ida. The team had briefly considered pulling out some old technology for the job. There was a spare Apollo space capsule on display at the Visitor Center of Goddard. It could technically be recommissioned and used, but that was decades-old technology that they had very little experience with. They had contacted the Russians about commissioning a Soyuz. If they had a spare Soyuz sitting around, at least that technology, although as old as the Apollo, was something that had been used as recently as 2 decades before. However, they had no luck with the Soyuz. The Russians had been hit hard by the downslide in the economy during the war. Anything they had in storage from their space program had been parted out and sold to help support the war effort. Ali spotted the cafe in the distance. He crossed the street, staring down at the blacktop with his head full of heavy thoughts. When he reached the door, he found a handwritten sign taped to the inside that said, "Closed for servicing." He grabbed the handle and jangled the door angrily. All he got in return was a loud thunk as the lock slammed into the doorframe. With no other option, he let out a sigh of defeat and turned around to head back to the makeshift mission control room. Despite the disappointment about the coffee, the walk had done him some good. His mind felt clearer and his muscles were starting to spring back from hours spent hunched over the screen at his desk. But all the fresh air in the world hadn't given him what he really wanted. He still had no idea how he was going to save Ida. And that thought bothered him more than all his other thoughts combined. Thanks for listening, sci-fi fans. Tune into the next episode to see how Ida and Ali's relationship continues to grow and how they discover the breakthrough that just might save Ida's life. You don't want to miss it. See you then. Bye.